So, hi, my name is Robert Rogers. I'm 55 years old, and I'm here with my friend Daniel Anthon. We are in Sarasota, Florida. Daniel, you want to introduce yourself?
I'm Dan Anthon. The first name is Daniel, spelled with two N's. It was a mistake on my birth certificate, so I started out life in that way. But yes, I'm 71, and we're here in Sarasota, Florida.
So I understand when I extend the invitation to do the interview to sit and talk with me, it sounds like you've given some thought to it, and you have something you'd like to share.
So. Well, yeah, I mean, after graduating from college in 1969, 50 years ago, I moved to New York City and lived in Greenwich Village and a couple of other places in New York. And it was at the time of Stonewall. And I remember very clearly, I was very involved in anti-Vietnam political activities, and I was a hippie freak with long hair and had a beard down my chest. My hair was down my back.
Nice.
My friends would tease it up and it would be in this big giant afro, and there were absolutely no pictures because we didn't believe in taking pictures back in those days.
So nothing was documented. Wow, yeah.
Down the street from where I lived on 11th Street in the Village, and the weathermen had a basement apartment where they were making bombs right next door to Dustin Hoffman, and he lived in a brownstone right next door. And I remember one day the bomb factory exploded and it blew their whole brownstone up, and it blew off the whole wall of Dustin Hoffman's brownstone. So on my street, a few blocks away, we went to take a look. It was really bizarre, really, really crazy. But me and my friends, we had a really tight group of people, and we were very involved in politics and had gone to the march in Washington to close down the May Day demonstrations in Washington. All got arrested like lots of times for it. And we're back in New York, and there was this big march down, I think it might have been Broadway, I don't remember what street it was, but we were all marching, and it was anti-war stuff, but it was also Free Angela Davis and everything else under the sun. And I'm marching down the street, and I'm with this whole group of drag queens. Uh-huh. And in my own mind, it was kind of like, okay, I don't get what's going on here. I don't really even understand what this is all about. And later on, we found out about the Stonewall riots and transvestites kind of like taking their power in their own hands and kind of like igniting this whole thing. And it seemed like overnight, almost everyone I knew came out. Like all of my friends, male and female. It seemed like almost every single person I knew, all of a sudden, they were not gay, and the next day everybody was gay.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't feel comfortable with that. And I just felt I was raised Catholic. My family they were already outraged enough about my politics. Mm-hmm. I remember getting arrested for a demonstration after the Kent State uprisings. And my name was on the front page of my hometown paper. And my father didn't talk to me for a whole year after that.
Wow.
So coming out would have been, you know, catastrophic everywhere. And so I kind of avoided it for a really long time and ended up moving to Colorado and was a ski bum for a while and fell in love with a guy in Colorado. And
how old were you at this point?
I think I was like 20, 21 years old, somewhere in that range. And so I fell in love with this guy. We were just gonna move in together. We had never had sex or anything. It just was like this whole culmination of everything coming together. And finally, I felt like I was really coming out and I was gonna be honest with myself.
Yeah.
And I panicked. The night before we were supposed to move in, I didn't do it. I didn't tell him. I just ran off somewhere. I did not do it. And eventually I moved into an ashram. I had a guru, meditated, lived in an ashram for 10 years.
Yeah.
And I hid this secret away inside of me for all that time.
Did you never communicate with this guy ever again?
I did not ever talk to him again. It's like, it's wow. It's a, I mean, actually your reaction to me is kind of a,
it's
freaky to me in a sense, because I, at the time it was so.
And I'm not judging you.
No. I mean, you should be judging me, actually, to tell you the truth, because I hadn't really even thought about it in that way. I probably owe him some kind of an amends. I hadn't even really thought about that. That's kind of cool.
I'm sorry I'm kind of stuck here for a second, but have you ever tried to find him?
Or? I have not.
Okay.
I have absolutely not ever done that. You know, but I think, I mean, not in my defense, but in an understanding of my own behavior, because I ended up becoming a therapist in my later years. I think that what I was actually doing was, it was so traumatic, the idea of coming out, and I kind of had a sense of what it would be if I did. And I think that when I ran the other direction, I ran as far and as fast and as complete as I could. I did not want to own that part of myself.
Period.
At all.
Right.
And so what did I do? I moved into a situation where I took vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience, almost like a Catholic monk. And for the entire time, almost, that I was in the ashram, I lived that. And a lot of other people didn't. People went out and had sexual relationships, mostly male-female.
Did you say 10 years?
You 10 were in, years.
Wow.
10 years.
Okay.
And so, I mean, it was a really interesting thing because we lived in houses where there would be men and women together, and I never had an issue with sexuality, whereas a lot of the other people did. You know, some of the women in the ashrams would get pregnant, or, you know, guys would actually hook up with women and stuff like that. Maybe not necessarily in the house, but other people. And I never had any issue with that at all. And then at one point, they decided to make the ashrams male or female oriented.
Okay.
That's when the issues started to come to the surface for me. Because now I'm forced to live in a community of men. And I.
And the proximity probably presented some opportunities. And
it's really. Yeah. And I would typically fall in love with straight guys, so it wasn't necessarily that it was a healthy, good thing to
do. Right.
So, this is really going in a different direction than I even have envisioned. Yeah, so that's good, actually.
Okay. Yeah.
But I think that the coming out process, I think that for a lot of us was tragic and difficult, and it wasn't like, you know, self, you know. Affirming. It was like a very negative experience in a lot of ways. And if you went to a gay bar back in those days, which I did eventually when I moved out of the ashram and I realized that this is ridiculous, I have to confront this, I can't just live in this way anymore. I want a relationship, I want to understand my sexuality, and I can't do it here adequately or properly or honestly or ethically. So I need to go out and do this on my own. In the beginning years, I was living in Washington, D.C., and going to a gay bar in Washington, D.C. back in those days was bizarre. The windows were dark, so nobody could see in, or they were in an industrial district. I remember going to the first gay nightclub that I ever went to back in those days. This is in the 70s. It was like, I don't know, it was like going to the gym. I mean, everybody was like toned and muscled and, you know, the dancing was kind of like calisthenics that people were doing. I mean, it was like, I didn't even know what to think about it. I really didn't know what to think about it. Like, you had to know somebody who had been there before
to get in.
Okay. Because the door wasn't even advertised.
Right? Yeah.
There was no sign on the door. Like, you just had to know where it was in the middle of this industrial
district.
That
might have been out of fear, too.
Not only that, fear is one thing, but when you go in these districts, it's not safe, really, necessarily, because they're in an area that, you know, not necessarily policed unless the police were doing a raid.
Got it.
And so I don't know. I remember, you know, sitting in this bar in Washington, D. I have a very clear memory of this right now. I hadn't really thought about this for years, but sitting in that bar in Washington, D.C., and having a drink at the bar in a room where all the men were possible partners. Okay. They weren't straight guys. These were gay guys in this bar.
Yeah.
It felt like I was doing something incredibly dangerous.
Huh.
It just felt so frightening.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it also felt exhilarating at the same time.
Yeah, it was totally.
Holy cow. And but eventually, but that was, that experience was how I got there. I moved out of the ashram and I was in love with a guy in the ashram, but he was a straight guy. And
did he know how you felt about
him? He knew exactly how I felt. Okay. And so he was an incredibly wonderful guy. That's what was so nice about it, in a sense. Like, I introduced him to his future wife. And the three of us, and there was a point where they were going to get married. And she was having doubts about it. So she and I got in a car. This is in Miami. We drove. We were all in the ashram together. Mm-hmm. She and I drove in a car. We were heading to Key West, and all the while we were on the road, we were processing whether she was going to marry my best friend.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
did she know it? She knew how you felt.
She knew how I felt about him too. Okay. I didn't like hide anything from either of them.
Okay.
And so it eventually got to the point where they did get married, and I was the best man at their wedding. And this is a funny part of the story too. Like, he was this guy that I was in love with, who now was marrying my other best friend.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the wedding was at the country club in Buffalo, New York, where my family lived.
Going from an ashram to a country club.
Right? And my mother worked at this country club. My mother was the woman who shined the shoes in the golf room.
Okay.
Where the rich people came, and she shined their shoes and took care of their stuff in the locker room. And my friend's mother was a person in the country club. She was a member. And so they had this big giant wedding, really fancy thing. I'm the best man.
Yeah.
And my mom is the woman who shines the shoes.
How did that make you feel? I mean, did you have any sort of difficult feelings about that?
Oh my God, are you kidding me? Yeah. It was awful. I mean, and I felt like my feelings had to take a back seat to this, because I love both of them, and I didn't want to be, you know, like a thorn in their relationship in any way, shape, or form. And we are still friends today.
I was going to ask.
So.
And I was hoping to hear that. Yeah.
And that is the truth of the matter. And I mean, we've had some, you know, Mark and I have had some difficulties over the years, because he's struggled with his own issues. And just this past couple years, I went to Washington, D.C. to the Women's March after the Trump inauguration with my niece. She and I took a road trip to D.C. We stayed at Mark and Judy's house.
Okay, so that's where they are.
Yeah,
okay.
So they live in D.C., so they still live there. But at the time that, you know, after Mark and Judy got married, I was there for a while, and I actually lived in their house with them for a while, but that was just so hard for me, really hard, really, really hard.
I would imagine.
And there was a guy who I had been off and on in love with in the ashram, and he eventually, we ended up meeting in New York City by accident. He was living in California.
Like, bumped into him, kind of thing?
Well, we were at a conference for our guru.
Okay.
So it wasn't like a total accident, but I didn't know he was going. Right. He didn't know I was going.
Yeah.
He was in California. I was in D.C. And we we connected with each other in this way again. We had always loved each other. And so we, you know, Dick actually came and stayed with us at Mark and Judy's house.
Oh, wow.
And I had the most profound sexual experience I've ever had in my entire life with Dick in Mark and Judy's house.
And it's poetic.
It was a little bit difficult for those guys because they didn't have as much respect for Dick as I did.
Okay.
And they saw him as, I don't know, like a flake or, you know, not very serious. And he was in D.C., but I was in, he was in San Francisco and I was in D.C. But eventually Dick and I did work it out where we ended up, Dick moved to D.C. He left everything in San Francisco.
Oh, wow.
And moved to D.C. It's not a happy ending.
Yeah. So,
well, but yeah. But Dick was like, we got our own apartment together and the thought of ourselves as being married, you know, it wasn't marriage at the time or anything.
And you were a couple.
We were a couple.
Yeah.
And I thought we were a monogamous couple. No, we're not. Shocked me, to tell you the truth. I was really, really... And at that time, being monogamous, this is like in the early 80s, was not acceptable. It was absolutely not acceptable. It was like if you were a couple and you were monogamous, no one believed you. Because everyone believed that you were cheating or having whatever on the side, or that your relationship was open and it was acceptable. That wasn't... In my mind, what was happening? In my mind, we were monogamous.
Uh-huh.
Well, I found out we would meet this friend of ours for, you know, dinner or something like that, and he would trick in the bathroom before we got there.
Huh.
And I had no idea that was happening. This is right at the height, right at the beginning of the AIDS epidemic, and so when I found this out, I really didn't know what to do. I was just so devastated in my
head. You freaked out.
Totally freaked out.
Yeah.
But I was not going to leave him. I was not. I mean, I was like, and in my own mind, it was like, if he has AIDS, then I'll have AIDS.
Wow.
That's kind of how I felt. It was like, this is it. And so eventually we ended up leaving D.C. and friends of mine had a natural foods grocery in Chicago. And so I didn't really want to go, but he really wanted to go because they hired us over the phone because of me.
Okay.
And he really wanted this job. And I had a job at an accounting firm in D.C., and I didn't really necessarily want to leave, but I was not going to leave him.
Wow.
So we came to Chicago, and in my mind, I thought, oh, this is going to make our relationship better.
But you were willing to sacrifice everything.
Everything, basically. When we got to Chicago, though, it was awful, really. I mean, he was going out a lot, and I was home by myself, and, I was just totally freaked out all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, he stopped having sex with me. And to his credit, I think he understood that he had AIDS.
Okay.
And that he didn't really want to give me AIDS. Mm-hmm. And so therefore he stopped having sex with me. He didn't say any of that. He didn't communicate any of that. And I'm not even 100% sure he knew.
Okay.
But he was doing a lot of risky things.
So he never shared a diagnosis with you or anything?
Not at that point.
Okay.
So eventually we ended up breaking up and I moved out on my own, which I went into. I drank a lot. I was doing a lot of drugs. I went out, and that was like a period of time where I had a lot of risky sexual behaviors myself. Sex in the parks, sex in the back of cars, I mean, everything under the sun, unprotected, pretty much, too. And I didn't care, really. I honestly did not care.
It sounds like it was destructive.
Oh, it was awful, really. Yeah. It was really awful. But, I ended up deciding to make a change. I wasn't really that comfortable with sex in the parks and all that. It was exciting, but it was too scary at that time. And we all knew what was sort of on the horizon.
Mm-hmm.
And so I ended up, I started going to a group called Skin Hunger.
It
was run by a social worker for men who wanted to learn how to have intimate communication with other men without sex to, as the beginning.
Yeah, yeah.
Status, like.
You mean like a dialogue that would lead to some sort of sexual satisfaction, like that? I mean.
Well, what it was called Skin Hunger, and it was run by a social worker, and it was an 8-week group, mm-hmm. and you had to commit to not have sex with anybody in the group for that 8 weeks. So he took us through a series of all kinds of exercises to learn how to trust other men. Without sex being the thing.
Yeah.
Like you had to go stay overnight at someone's home. You had to sleep in their arms and not have sex. You had to commit to this. We had to do trust exercises where you'd go outside and blindfold each other and walk around in a dangerous area so that you trusted the other person that they would keep you safe.
Wow.
So the thing that happened here
sounds kind of extraordinary.
I met my current partner of 35 years
in that group. Oh, did you? So after the 8 weeks, you guys were like, okay, let's do this.
That's it. So it was, I don't know, it was like, so even, let's see, we were together, Robert and I were together, my partner's name is Robert, he's my husband now, and we were living in this tiny studio apartment. And it was about a year, I think, after Dick and I broke up, maybe a little longer, maybe a year and a half. Well, Dick now has full-blown AIDS. And I'm in graduate school, becoming an art therapist. And the population I end up working with is HIV.
I think I remember you telling me that.
The story.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know, you know, Dick calls me up one day and says, we need to get together. And so I had no animosity towards him, especially now. Mm-hmm. We've always been friends. We were friends before we were lovers. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to necessarily not be friends with him.
Right.
And so we were. And we would go to parties at his house or other people's houses, Robert and I both would.
Mm-hmm.
And so I go and I meet with him, and he goes, I have some news I have to tell you. I'm HIV positive. And I have full-blown AIDS. And he started having all sorts of opportunistic infections. And our other best friend also had full-blown AIDS at the time. And he ended up moving back to San Francisco, and that's where he died. And
this is Dick, you mean?
Dick died, okay. Yeah. Okay. And Philip, our other friend, was in Chicago. And because I had a lot of experience with HIV, mm-hmm. Philip used me as a sounding board throughout his illness and right up until the day before he died.
So did you find yourself in a caregiver role at that point? Or
not with Dick.
With Philip.
With Philip, I think. But Dick went back to San Francisco, and that's the sad part is that he ended up, our other friends actually went out to see him as he was dying.
Mm-hmm.
And he had dementia. I mean, it was affecting his brain. I mean, it was so sad, really, really, really sad.
Did he go back because he had a support network there? Or
he
just
did.
His
brother lived out there.
Okay.
And he moved there. I think he always had, like, he loved San Francisco. And he left San Francisco for me. And then when that wasn't working for him, he had a lot of friends in Chicago, too. But I think San Francisco really was his home.
Yeah.
And so he ended up going there basically, I think, to die.
Mm-hmm.
And his family was around him. They didn't reject him and all that.
Thank God for that.
Yeah, I mean, really. He was so fortunate.
Yeah, because you hear so many horror stories.
But his end was not pretty by any shake of the imagination. And that's what I think a lot of people don't understand, like with HIV today, is that AIDS is horrible.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really horrible disease.
Mm-hmm.
When I first started working with HIV, seeing people with Kaposi sarcoma, I mean, that was just like, my first client in graduate school in an internship, one of my first clients was a guy with Kaposi's. And the nursing staff tried to prepare me for what he would look like, because he really looked like a monster. He had oozing purple lesions all over his body, his whole face. I mean, I could see his beautiful eyes
mm-hmm.
in there,
mm-hmm.
and it was just lovely to see the soul basically of this person,
yeah,
but encrusted in this horrible stuff.
An image you've never forgotten that image.
I've never forgotten that image.
Yeah.
In fact, as an art therapist, I remember here I am sitting in this session with this guy, and I was kind of grossed out, and I didn't want those feelings, but you couldn't really help it.
Mm-hmm.
And so in my drawing I kind of like did this face or head, and I put like a covering over the head.
Mm-hmm.
This is unconsciously. I didn't know I was even doing it until I looked down at myself. I was totally appalled that I had done it. I put like a Darth Vader mask over this person's face.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized what I was doing.
And he was sitting across
from me. He was sitting right across from me. And I realized I was like, oh my God, this is why they warn you not to do drawings with people. It's like, you let out this thing. And then I thought, I stepped back and I thought, this is my feeling. I mean, I can't pretend that that's not there.
Did you talk? You must have talked.
He didn't want to ever talk. This is the weirdest thing that I had. One of the strangest, not the strangest, but one of the strangest things, especially as a beginning therapist, is the guy didn't really want to talk. He wanted to listen to soap operas on TV in the room.
Did he draw?
While we were drawing.
Okay.
So
interesting.
I'm drawing this thing, and I look at it, and I'm like totally, beating myself up. What? Then I step back and I said, okay, it's my drawing. Own it. Deal with it. And I started like just incorporating the mask and everything into the drawing. I still have this drawing.
Wow.
And I, in that process, I accepted him. I accepted my feelings.
Yeah.
I accepted who he was. And I looked in his eyes and I saw the real person, which a lot of people were not able to do because all they saw was the outside.
Uh-huh.
The very next session, he comes in. He saw what I had done before. He had an eyelash in his eye, and he couldn't remove it. And we're in the hospital.
Yeah.
He said, "Could you help me with this?" And I didn't flinch. I did not even flinch. I went right over and I took a tissue and I was able to pull the eyelash out of his eye. And it was like, from then on, it was magical.
Really. That's so powerful.
Oh my God. Like acceptance. Like when you accept another human being and all their like, whatever is happening to them.
How extraordinary.
Yeah, really. One of the things that I realized my whole career, I dealt with people with HIV, at least in one aspect of my career. And in my storefront studio that I had eventually in Chicago some 20-some years later, I had all my notes from the time that I had worked on that unit. And one day, I pulled them out. And I had a group of HIV people who came to my studio every week for years, 15 years. Some of them came for almost the entire time. Not always, not for, they would go away, they'd come back, whatever. And I'm still there working with people.
Yeah.
So I opened up this box one day in my studio, and I went, what the hell is this? And it was all the notes that I had from my time back on that unit. What I did not realize, and I remembered all their faces, I remembered their names, I remembered who they were, I remembered their stories even. I did not remember that they all died. Because on my little index card, I noted that every single person had died.
Did you put the date or something? Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was just phenomenal to me. I sat down in my studio. And
what a privilege.
Oh my God. It was like, but here I have all these notes. And I'm thinking to myself, what am I going to do with this? I can't throw them away.
No, you can't.
I can't.
Or at least that's my feeling as well. I agree with you.
I was
you cannot
tearful. I mean, I was really beside myself.
Well, and, I mean, you relived every relationship.
Oh, totally. Totally. I mean, I remembered so vividly, and I still right now here thinking about this. There was one man who was a Catholic priest, and he didn't tell his congregation that he was gay or that he had AIDS,
mm-hmm.
and here he is in the hospital, full blown AIDS. And he was getting endoscopy, I think it was, and he had to have his lungs kind of really cleared out, because I think he had pneumocystis pneumonia. And it's a horrible procedure, really horrible procedure. And so he was just, when he came back from there, I was with him in his room, and he had no energy whatsoever. He couldn't even lift his hands at all. And his parishioners were calling him to see how he was. They knew he was in the hospital, but they didn't know why.
And did he?
So I sat next to his bed, and I answered the phone for him, and he just slept. And that was my art therapy session with this man. I took care of him.
What did you share with him? I mean, that's...
I just said that he's resting and he'd call you back when he had a chance. But they, you know, it's like all kinds of things. I mean, at the time, another person, this is...
All the shame attached to that, though. I mean, the thought that somebody would transition out of this life submerged in so much shame.
Yeah. It was horrible, really.
I mean, God, it really makes you...
Yeah, it totally does. In my unit, when I was in my internship, I was working on the Catholic hospital that took a really long time to get an HIV designated unit. And because Catholic Church didn't condone homosexuality. And so for them to have an HIV unit on that hospital took a lot. And it was DIFA, the design, gay designers actually, foot the bill for the whole unit.
They created the space, probably.
They created the space. They got the hospital to do it. It was a beautiful unit. And the staff on that unit were incredible, really. Really, absolutely incredible. But I, at the time that I was in that internship, one of my really good friends was on Illinois Masonic, which was an openly gay unit where all the openly gay people went. Mm-hmm. Where I went was all the closeted gay people went. And then there was Cook County Hospital, which was a public hospital. And our friend Carol, she worked on the HIV unit there. And what it was like on her unit compared to what it was like on both of our units was like night and day, really.
So the public hospital was what you sort of imagine? Is that what you're saying?
It's like the worst place that you could possibly imagine. It was every person who went into a person with HIV in those days were totally gowned, masked, and gloved. Mm-hmm. So that if you were, say you were had some dementia going on in your head, here's this person coming in the room.
I hadn't even thought
totally
about
frightened.
That.
Absolutely frightened to death.
Yeah.
Carol would go into their rooms. She's an art therapist, but she understood what HIV was. We all talked about it in school. We learned, you know, universal precautions. You don't have to wear a gown.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to deal with body fluids, you wear gloves.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, that's a universal precaution. Everyone does that.
Mm-hmm.
But back then, that wasn't the case. People would go in bare hands. But in her case, like, we knew about universal precaution, so she would wear gloves. She would walk in the room. Outside would be the person's tray. They were on an IV, right?
Mm-hmm.
No way in hell they could actually go outside and get their food tray. It would not be possible for them to do it.
Right.
She'd go to their room. Here's this person's food was outside in the floor.
Mm-hmm.
He wouldn't have been able to eat. Or they had diapers. Their diapers were messed. Mm-hmm. And they had been laying in their poop or their piss for hours. Carol would go in, gloves in her hand, no mask, no gown, and change the diapers for them. She's an art therapist. It wasn't her job, but she did it because she wasn't afraid.
Mm-hmm.
And we were all, I mean, that's like, we would compare the three units. And we'd also compare the artwork to the three units, which was really interesting. Like the...
Oh my God, that must have been...
But the imagery was very much the same. I mean, a lot of like dead trees, no leaves on the trees, you know, people were like, it was like... interesting, the people who were on her unit were more poverty stricken, so their artistic ability maybe wasn't quite as sophisticated,
mm-hmm.
but the basic imagery was very similar.
Mm-hmm.
And we had incredible discussions about all that.
So they were all communicating the same feelings.
Yeah, the same feelings. So there was no difference, really.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I automatically assumed that the images would have been different.
Yeah. Not really.
You know, for each institution or what have you, but.
Well, and the thing that was, I think, really hard for me is because these guys were all my age.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really basically confronting death. At that point, I was like in my
every day
30s, mid-30s, I think. I was confronting it every single day.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's had an effect on me, I think, over my life. I do remember this one guy, vibrant guy, his lover was there, real supportive of him, but he no longer had the ability to speak. You know, he was losing all functioning control of his body,
mm-hmm.
body parts, had no ability to even lift anything with his hands. He was in a wheelchair all the time, being pushed around. I remember sitting with him and his lover, and you could tell that he was totally intact in his mind and his body.
But trapped inside this.
Him.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was begging his partner
to
like let him go. And what do you do? I mean, how can you do that? You know, I mean, I would have totally respected somebody.
Of course. Yeah. Oh yeah. 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 I don't know why that's not a universal practice.
Absolutely.
Actually allowing people to make decisions about.
I don't either. But the other guy the one who had the Kaposi's, one day he came to my group religiously. Even when he was when he was an outpatient, the people could come back to my group.
Mm-hmm.
They were allowed to. So he was always there. He always came. And one day he didn't show up. And I was like, what happened to him? So I made a few calls, found out that the hospital driver that was supposed to pick him up at his place, when he started walking out of the apartment to get into the car, refused to pick him up. Because of the way he looked, because he looked like a monster.
Mm-hmm.
And the driver would not pick him up. Well, I was furious.
Mm-hmm.
I was absolutely furious. So I went to my boss at the time. I'm a student,
mm-hmm.
okay?
Right.
I was so angry. I cannot tell you how angry I was. And between my boss and I really getting on people's cases, we got the driver fired for what he had done. Because that was totally unacceptable. And this man, like when he finally couldn't make it to the hospital anymore. So I was allowed to go to his house. He lived in a group home for people with HIV.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember sitting on his bed with him the very last day of his life, and he was wanting to draw this drawing that showed him on an island. You know, deserted,
mm-hmm.
all by himself,
mm-hmm.
alone.
Mm-hmm.
And it kept looking like a mountain with him at the top of this mountain in a much more glorious
mm-hmm.
way than he was trying to portray himself. Because in reality, what a lot of these guys experienced was, even though they had been closeted, they came out while they were at this hospital on this unit,
mm-hmm.
they got a great deal of acceptance from
mm-hmm.
all the staff and their doctors
mm-hmm.
initially, and then even from a lot of their families. And so they came out, basically. They had a coming out party on the unit.
That's amazing.
When they're dying.
Yeah.
but they had it before
yeah.
they died. And
that acceptance.
And acceptance, right. So here's this man, you know, he's like, I'm sitting on the bed with him, really intimate, and I'm doing my best to try to help him draw this picture of being him on a deserted island, but it couldn't be a deserted island.
Yeah, right.
It was so incredible.
That's, yeah,
really.
Wow.
It was just so beautiful, really. So he ends up dying, and I get a phone call from his family. They ask me to come to his funeral, which is not something we did all the time because it happened so frequently.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, there's no way I can't go. I have to go to this. I went to the funeral, and he had never talked to me really about his work because this is the guy who didn't want to talk. What he told me was that everyone was always prodding and pushing him to express. And I never did that with him. And so he was really grateful. He didn't have to explain anything. He didn't have to go into any detail about all that. At his wake, his minister got up, and the whole eulogy was about the art that he did with me.
Wow.
It was like, I was so floored. I was like, there was this, he was talking to his minister about it. He wasn't talking to me about it.
Yeah.
But he was talking to his minister about it. And it was like, I didn't feel bad that he hadn't talked to me about it. I was really happy that he didn't, because it was like the place where he could have some peace or some respite at the end of his life.
Yep.
Where he wasn't judged and he was totally loved. And that, I mean, it,
God,
you know, that's, it's like all of us in our lives, it's like, as gay people, we are ostracized in so many really, really strange and...
We are. And even no matter how subtle it is, I mean, we are painfully aware of it.
Painfully aware of it. It's just horrible, really. And,
yeah.
And it's better today, obviously. You know, there's a whole lot of really, really good things. You know, we even have a candidate who's running for president.
Yeah.
Happens to be an openly gay man, and he's actually... you know, was closeted for a long time himself, and he's young, and that's unusual, I guess, in a way. And
well, I think you and I talked about, I mean, or, you know, it's, I mean, you know, because you and I met in our monthly discussion group that we have here. But, you know, I think I've referenced my upbringing a couple of times that was, I lived in a bubble.
Yeah.
You know, the discrimination happened once I left my parents, because I grew up in this totally accepting household. You know, never came out. It was just, you love who you love. I mean, that's the house I grew up in.
Yeah.
And it was really weird to leave that bubble and encounter such, I just assumed that everybody was accepting and loving and that you loved who you loved and nobody, you know, and it was all cool, right? And patchouli scented and, you know, whatever. And then it was really bizarre. I still struggle with that, in fact. I cannot, it's hard for me to accept the level of discrimination spit at each other all the time. I just can't get my head around it.
Yeah.
Well,
I didn't have that experience, to tell you the truth. It wasn't like that for me.
Yeah.
When Robert and I got together, we're close. 2 more minutes left, I think.
Oh my God.
When he and I got together, my dad was pretty homophobic, and so he never got to meet my dad. My dad died. And then after my dad died, my mom was in the middle of cancer. So I did bring him home to meet my mom. And my mom really loved him. And they got along really well. And but my dad never did, because I was afraid of how my dad would actually respond to him. I didn't want him to, you know, be mistreated or whatever. And his family have always accepted me, you know, as a person. I was the only guy that he ever dated that they really liked, and so that was fortunate. And but his mother and father had their own kind of homophobia. Like, they didn't introduce us to their friends because of his mother, and eventually we discovered that they were doing that, and so for 2 years we didn't speak to them. But that made a difference, because when we finally did get back with them, the relationship was a lot different, and there was a lot more respect. And his father's still alive, 95, and his father always treated me like his son.
Yeah.
When we would go out places together, which we did often, the four of us, he always introduced me as his son, which in one sense I know was not my son's husband, it's my son.
Yeah.
So there's edginess to that, but it's also, it showed me that he really loved me for who I was.
And you know, it's amazing, because I guess as we're running out of time, it's it takes this, you know? It's just getting to know somebody and understanding, you know, that it's one human to another.
Yep.
Daniel, I really appreciate you talking with me, and I feel like our friendship has really
stronger as a result of this.
I love it too.
So totally thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right.
Boy, we did it.